All right, I'd like you to take your Bible this morning and turn to Romans chapter 8. When we do it God's way, He wants us to be the head and not the tail. In the next two messages, we're going to talk more about how and the kingdom will be ours once again.
Welcome to Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. The focus of this ministry is to open the eyes of our people and give insight into the issues we find ourselves facing in this day and age. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska 69363, or you can reach us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here's Ted Weiland.
1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 7 through 14. 1 Corinthians 9, beginning with verse 7, it says, "Who goeth to warfare at any time at his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not the fruit thereof? Or who feedeth a flock and eateth not the milk of the flock?" Rhetorical questions, of course. He says, "Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law that for it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care of oxen, or saith he it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that ploweth should plow in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope. If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it such a great thing if we shall reap your material things? If others be partakers of this power over you, are not we rather? Nevertheless, we have not used this power, but suffer all things, lest we should hinder the gospel of Christ." Verse 13, Do you not know, that they which minister about holy things live of the things of the temple, and they which wait at the altar are partakers of the altar? Even so has the Lord ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel." All right, this will be Kingdom Tithing, Part 6. And we are presently in the process of proving that the tithe is indeed New Covenant applicable through a number of different ways. Thus far, we've addressed 5 of 10 ways that I know of in which this, in fact, is demonstrated, that the tithe is indeed New Covenant applicable. Number 1, by Yahweh's everlasting sovereignty. Number 2, by the Abrahamic covenant precedent. Number 3, by the Melchizedek model. Number 4, by the 2 Chronicles 31, verse 4 paradigm. And number 5, by the Malachi 3 and 4 New Covenant prophecies. And we didn't quite finish this last one in the last message, so let's return, if you will, to Malachi chapter 3. Because although we have already, we could in fact stop right where we did with Malachi 3 and 4 in the last message, and it's already proven that in fact Malachi 3 in particular, and chapter 4 as well, is all, or at least the part that we covered, is certainly new covenant prophecy, new covenant relative prophecy. However, there's some additional information here that further substantiates the fact that this is new covenant applicable and is a new covenant prophecy that I don't want you to miss out on. So let's return there, Malachi chapter 3. In the previous message, we discussed the prophecies regarding John the Immerser in Malachi 3:1 and Malachi chapter 4 and verses 5 through 6. We looked at the 70 AD implications found in both Malachi 3 and Malachi 4. We also discussed the fact that much of the language found in Malachi chapter 3 regarding the blessings and curses related to tithing in chapter 3 again is taken from Deuteronomy chapter 28 and are thus new covenant applicable like all of the rest of what we find in Deuteronomy 28. And which then brings us to Malachi 3:12 and where we left off with the previous message. And keep in mind as we go to Malachi 3, and verse 12 eventually here, keep in mind that all of this From Malachi 3 and verse 1 through Malachi 4 and verse 6, the last verse of the book of Malachi, is one continuous narrative. It's not like this is all broken up. This is all dealing, it's one continuing narrative, or essentially one continuous prophecy, or at least a number of New Covenant prophecies that are all related, particularly, obviously, to the New Covenant. But it's not chopped up and dealing with different things here. It is one continuous or one narrative of several Old Covenant prophecies all dealing with the New Covenant and the same things. So with that in mind, let's pick it up in Malachi chapter 3. We want to get to verse 12, but let's start reading again with verse 7. And again, for the purpose of getting this continuous flow of what's happening here. Malachi chapter 3, beginning with verse 7, it says, "Even from the days of your fathers you are gone away from my statutes," as it should have been translated in the King James and is in other translations. "Even from the days of your fathers you are gone away from my statutes and have not kept them. Return unto me, and I will return unto you, saith Yahweh of hosts. But you said, wherein shall we return? Will a man rob God?" Here's his answer. Will a man rob God? At least this is part of his answer. This is where he begins with his answer, at least in this particular instance. He says, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. You are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring ye all the tithes unto the storehouse, that there may be meat." I decided to look up that word meat there. Interesting word. It's only translated meat in two different places in the Old Testament, here and I believe in Psalms. And the word really means spoil. It's often translated as prey, and or with the indication of being spoil. Is the word really means. So he says, "Bringing all the tithes under the storehouses, that they're not necessarily meat, but spoil. In not spoiled meat, but spoil, as in the spoils of war or the bounty of whatever it takes." Which fits into the rest of this as well. As we get down in here, it starts talking about that the devourer will be rebuked. The devourer, whoever's devouring, he's the one probably in control. And if he's rebuked and destroyed and put away, you're going to end up with a spoil. Spoils of warfare, essentially, spiritual or otherwise. Again, let's go back and read that again. Verse 16, "Bringing in all the tithes unto the storehouses, that there may be meat or spoil in my house. And prove me now herewith, saith Yahweh of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall be room enough to receive it." Verse 11, and then it says, "And I will rebuke the devourer for your sakes, and he shall not destroy the fruits of your ground, neither shall your vine cast her fruit before the time in the field, saith Yahweh of hosts." And then in verse 12 it says, "And all nations shall call you blessed, for you shall be a delightsome land, saith Yahweh of hosts." Now I want to center in particularly on verse 12, and particularly the two words, delightsome land. And do not overlook that this result, at least in part, that this is a result, at least in part, this result of what he says, "And you shall be called a delightsome land," is the result, at least in part, from restoring the tithe. When? Well, if we take the rest of what we've already learned from Malachi 3, we've got to say New Covenant. But let's just set that aside and still ask the question, when? When is this prophecy about them becoming a delightsome land going to take place? Well, this is essentially the same New Covenant prophecy found in Isaiah 62, verses 1 through 4. Let's turn there, if you will, please. Isaiah 62, verses 1 through 4. Beginning with verse 1, it says, "For Zion's sake will I not..." First of all, I want you to, as I read this, I want you to decide whether this is a New Covenant prophecy or not here, as we find here in Isaiah 62. And also, is it a parallel prophecy? Is it essentially the same prophecy that we find in Malachi 3? You decide. Malachi 62, "For Zion's sake will I..." will I not hold my peace? And for Jerusalem's sake, I will not rest until the righteousness thereof go forth as brightness and the salvation, therefore, as a lamp that burneth. Verse 2. Now, it's not really clear yet there, but look at verse 2. And the Gentiles, or nations, shall see thy righteousness, and all the kings thy glory, and thou shalt be called by a new name, which the mouth of Yahweh shall name. What's the new name? Christians, isn't it? Same prophecy as we find in Isaiah 65, verse 15. Everyone accepts that the new name that's being described here in Isaiah, well, I can't say everybody, but most everybody, accepts that the name that's being described here is the name Christians, except for those who have a problem with the word Christ, which is, of course, ridiculous when you really examine their arguments in regards to that. But otherwise, people accept that this is talking about the word Christians. And when did the word Christians come into play? Well, not until the book of Acts. But that puts us square right in the middle of at least the beginning of the New Covenant era. So he says in the and verse 2 again, and the nations shall see thy righteousness and all the kings thy glory, and thou shalt be called by a new name which the mouth of Yahweh shall name. Thou shalt also be a crown of glory in the hand of Yahweh and a royal diadem in the hand of thy God. Verse 4, thou shalt no more... At this time, when thou art given a new name under the new covenant, it says, thou shalt no more be termed forsaken. When was Israel forsaken? When God divorced her. And he says, neither shall thy land, don't miss those two words, thy land any more be termed desolate. But thou shalt be called Hephzibah, and thy land Beulah, for Yahweh delighteth in thee, and thy land shall be married. What's it talking about? It's a new covenant prophecy about the remarriage of Yahweh to the house of Israel and the house of Judah. She had been forsaken when she was divorced. She became desolate. Her land became desolate. And he says, now the land is going to be called, and you're going to be called, Hephzibah and Beulah land. There's songs about Beulah land, isn't there? They need a song about Hephzibah land as well. Now, note, in your side column, if you have a side column like mine, the name Hephzibah, what's that mean? What's Hephzibah? Well, Hephzibah means my delight is in her. So God says, I'm going to name you in your land Hephzibah and Beulah land. And Hephzibah means my delight. That's why he names her Hephzibah, because he says, now I can delight in her again. She's no longer forsaken. She's no longer divorced. I'm bringing the remnant of Israel back, and she's now being married to me. And he says, and therefore I'm going to name you, my delight is in her. And that word delight, or Hephzibah, excuse me, is translated from a Hebrew word that is a derivative of the word translated delightsome in the phrase delightsome land in Malachi 3:12. It's the same new covenant prophecy that is the result in Malachi 3 of returning, or restoring, I should say, the tithe. It's a result, or at least in Malachi's prophecy, of returning to Yahweh and a result of restoring the tithe in the new covenant, because it is clearly, as well as the others we've already discussed, new covenant prophecy as found here in Isaiah 62. Lastly, in Malachi, back to Malachi 3. I don't know if that excites you, but that excited me to be able to link those two prophecies together and to see what's really being dealt with here in Malachi 3. Lastly, I want you to look at verse 17. In fact, let's begin with verse 16, which in and of itself has new covenant implications. Verse 16, it says, then they that feared Yahweh spake often one to another, and Yahweh hearkened. Again, one continuous, we jumped from 12 to verse 16, but was this all one continuous narrative? Verse 16, then they that feared Yahweh spake often one to another, and Yahweh hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them that feared Yahweh and that thought upon his name. When is this book of remembrance written about? Well, there's no book of remembrance ever written under the Old Covenant. It has to be talking about New Covenant. Then verse 17, it says, and they shall be mine, saith Yahweh of hosts, in that day. What day? All of its New Covenant prophecy. In that day, when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own son that serveth him. Now, again, if you've got footnotes, or side columns or center columns, look at the footnote for the word jewels there, and you'll find that if it's as mine, it says jewels or special treasure. Now, Israel had been his special treasure, hadn't she? The nation of Israel had been his special treasure when she took him on as his bride and his wife. But then he divorces her. And then in Isaiah 62 and here again in Malachi 3, he says, yeah, but I'm coming again and I'm going to remarry her and she will be my special treasure when I remarry her once again under the new covenant. This is future tense. Again, verse 17, and they shall be mine. Mine means married to me. That's new covenant marriage, matrimony language. And as a result, what she will she be? She'll be a special jewel. She'll be a special treasure, as we find again after the remarriage of Yahweh to Israel in 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. Listen, it is inescapable that all of Malachi 3 is new covenant prophecy, including Malachi's declarations concerning tithing. It's all dependent. All of these prophecies are, the pivotal point is tithing, the return to tithing in verses 8 through 12. And we could continue right on through, and there's more indications of the same right on through Malachi 4, not only those related to John the Immerser, but more New Covenant relative prophecy if we were to continue. Further demonstrating that all of this, Malachi 3 and 4, is New Covenant prophecy promoting and establishing a New Covenant tithe in and of itself. This, of course, brings us, now that we're finishing with Malachi, brings us right up to the New Covenant, doesn't it? The principal argument employed by those opposed to the New Covenant tithe is that tithing is never commanded in the New Covenant portion of the Scriptures. That is, from the book of Acts through the book of Revelation. The letter writer, under discussion here, puts it in the following fashion, quote, at least as it concerns Paul's writings. He says, Paul, who writes so strongly in favor of obeying God's law, never once mentions the tithe. And then a little bit later, he adds this. He says, Paul does not even hint at a tithe. End of quote. Well, we'll see about that. But it is true that Paul does not employ the word tithe in his writings. That is, of course, unless he's the author of the Epistle to the Hebrews. But for argument's sake, let's say he's not the author of Hebrews. And we've already seen in Hebrews when it was talking about Melchizedek, the word tithing is discussed there. And certainly in a new covenant relative way. But again, for argument's sake, let's say that Paul is not the author of the book of Hebrews, and therefore we should be able to all agree, we can all agree, that nowhere do we find Paul explicitly commanding a new covenant tithe. That we should be able to agree upon as long as we rule out the book of Hebrews. But at the same time, do not overlook this, and that is that nowhere does Paul or any other New Covenant author come close to commanding against or rescinding the tithe either. Both positions based on that kind of argument are arguments based on silence. He doesn't command the tithe, and he certainly doesn't command against the tithe. And therefore, both those for a new covenant tithe and those opposed to a new covenant tithe have to prove their position from other evidence. So let me ask you, what other evidence do those opposed to the new covenant tithe have to support their position? Well, when you really examine their arguments, get rid of all this extra stuff that so often accompanies their arguments against the tithe that are really irrelative to the whole question as far as the doctrinal question. When you really look at their arguments, they don't have any other evidence at all, except, quote unquote, except their argument that we don't have any Levites today, which Melchizedek alone proves is not required. And therefore, their only argument is to keep repeating that nowhere is tithing commanded in the new covenant. But something else that people don't sometimes consider in relation to that argument is that by the same argument, how many other laws does consistency then demand that we also eliminate from the new covenant? By that same argument, both the third, thou shalt not take the name of Yahweh thy God in vain, and the fourth commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, are therefore eliminated from the new covenant dispensation. You know that the third and fourth commandments, neither one are mentioned in the new covenant scriptures at all? Nowhere repeated. And, oh, by the way, this you already know because I've used it in other cases, bestiality is now permissible because nowhere is it condemned in the new covenant scriptures. Once again, what a web the letter writers and others weave for themselves with such an argument. And that's all their argument is based upon, that nowhere can we find the tithe commanded in the new covenant. All right, how about evidence for those who teach the new covenant tithe? Well, I've already provided you with five ways by which we know that the tithe is, in fact, a part of the new covenant today. But let's move on to number six. That is, by new covenant example, or by what we find in the New Testament itself. Let's begin by turning to Matthew chapter 22. Matthew chapter 22, and let's begin reading with verse 15 in this instance. Matthew 22, verse 15, it says, "And then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. And they sent out unto him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Master, we know that thou art true and teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of a man." Can you see the entrapment here, the flattery they're trying to catch him in and trying to build his ego up? And then it says, "Therefore tell us, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not?" But Yeshua perceived their wickedness and said, "Why temptest ye me, ye hypocrites?" And then in verse 19 he says, "Show me the tribute money." And they brought unto him a penny. Verse 20, "And he saith unto them, Whose is this image and subscription?" Verse 21, "And they said unto him, Caesar's. And then saith he unto them, Render therefore unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things which are God's." Now, without dressing everything herein, and there's a lot that's misunderstood in this last statement of Christ, but without addressing everything herein, because it would be irrelevant to do so, one thing is crystal clear from this passage, and that is that whatever Yahweh's due is, we should render it to him. Right? Right. That's crystal clear from this passage. Absolutely. Has that changed? Has that changed from the old covenant to the new covenant? Now, I'm confident that everyone would agree that Yeshua's statement there in verse 21 transcends all covenants. And therefore, we who live today under the new covenant need to render him his due as much as did those under the old covenant. I think we'd all agree upon that. Furthermore, being that Yahweh did not change, or does not change, the ultimate penalty and punishment, whatever that is, for not rendering him his due, is the same regardless of the covenant. He doesn't change, his judgment doesn't tame, whatever it is in God's sight that he's going to deal with those who do not render him his due, it transcends the covenants as well. And therefore, it's important that we figure out what is due. In other words, what was the penalty for not giving him his due under the old covenant is still the penalty and punishment under the new covenant, and it is therefore important we figure out what his due is today. So, what was his due under the old covenant? Well, among other things, it was a tithe, wasn't it? And what's his due under the new covenant? I mean, we can immediately say, everybody, I think, would agree, part of his due was the tithe, amongst offerings and other things. But what's his due under the new covenant? Well, if those who are opposed to the new covenant tithe and who believe that who believe in only a free will offering are correct, what's his due? Well, if they're correct, we really don't know what his due is. In fact, each and every Christian gets to decide for himself, if it's only based on free will offerings, each and every Christian gets to decide for himself what is Yahweh's due, which eliminates entirely the whole idea of something due to Yahweh. Being that something due is obligatory, whereas free will offerings are entirely arbitrary. You see the point? There is no due if there's just free will offerings under the new covenant. And in fact, once again, even more importantly, once again makes the giver sovereign instead of Yahweh. And eliminates, if you think about it, eliminates the possibility of judgment. Because how can you be judged if you're the one who gets to decide what his due is? Hopefully that reasoning makes sense. Only a designated and specified amount can provide Yahweh his due. And the only designated and specified amount provided to us in the Scriptures is the tithe. And therefore the tithe must itself still be new covenant relative, as proven by those that particular passage. Let's move on to Matthew chapter 23. Matthew chapter 23, and let's look at verse 23. Verse 23, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin." In other words, they were true to the tithe, those are the smallest of all grains. And so they were tithing, of course, probably from the wheat and the barley, of course, as well. But he says, man, you make a point to tithe when it comes to the very smallest of grains. You give a tenth. And he says again, for you pay tithe. Well, let me start again. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, or really justice, mercy, and faith. These, he says, you ought to have done, and not to have left the other undone. Now, first, is the tithe taught here by Yeshua? Well, yes, of course it is. And I'm sure everybody would agree to that, that there is the tithe is taught here by Yeshua. But those opposed to the new covenant tithe will be, I am sure, quick to point out that these are old covenant instructions. I'm sure that's how they would react. Wait a minute, you can't use this passage. These are old covenant instructions, not new covenant instructions. We're talking about a new covenant tithe, not an old covenant tithe. But are they Old Covenant instructions. Well, they were certainly given during the Old Covenant. That we can agree upon. But does that necessarily prove that they were Old Covenant instructions only? Let's find out. Turn back now to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, we want to begin reading here with verse 17. Matthew 5, 17 through 19. 17, it says, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law." Yeshua is the one here speaking. He says, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Whosoever therefore shall break one of these least commandments and shall teach men so, he shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whosoever shall do and teach them, the same shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." Kingdom of heaven, by the way, is new covenant relative in this case, in and of itself. So, question for you. Are those three verses, are those instructions from Yeshua old or new covenant instructions? Or both? Well, they're both, aren't they? And probably more new covenant than they actually are old covenant. So then what about verse 20? Let's look at verse 20. Verse 20, "For I say unto you that except your righteousness," not only dealing with those during the old covenant here, but very likely looking ahead to those who would live during the intervening time from the old covenant into the new covenant, which was about to come to be. He says, "For I say unto you that except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall in no case enter into the kingdom of heaven." Okay. Is that not new covenant instructions as well? Who would argue that that's not new covenant instructions as well? Isn't it incumbent upon us to have more righteousness than the stinking Pharisees did that Yeshua had such a difficult time with? For everybody's going to agree. Everybody should agree. unless they're beating a different drum than I think they are, that those are new covenant applicable as well. And if it is, would that not also apply to Matthew 23:3, that our righteousness, as it concerns with what we find in Matthew 23:3, that our righteousness has to exceed that of the Pharisees, making Yeshua's statement regarding the tithe there in Matthew 23:3 new covenant applicable as well? Now, I can understand if you're opposed to the new covenant tithe, that those who are, that they might initially be hesitant to agree to that. But there's something else that you need to consider about Matthew 23:3 before rejecting this altogether, this whole idea altogether, and that is Matthew 23:23's context. First, the rest of the verse, and then the remainder of the chapter. First, the rest of the verse. Jump back to Matthew 23:3. Let's read it again here. Matthew 23 and verse 23, it says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe, mint, and anise, and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment or justice, mercy, and faith. These ought you have done, and not to leave the other undone." Now, if Yeshua's statement herein, considering just the context of the verse itself, if Yeshua's statement herein regarding tithing, think about this, is only applicable to the Old Covenant, as some people would have it, then consistency demands that so is the second half of his same statement in the same verse regarding the weightier matters of the law. That is justice, mercy, and faith. Get rid of his point on tithing, and you have to, by the context. Consistency demands that then justice, mercy, and faith are no longer important either under the new covenant. How about the remainder of the chapter? How about the context of the entire chapter? Listen, there is not, and you can check this out for yourself because we're not going to go read the whole chapter, but there is not a single instruction or admonition in the balance of Matthew chapter 23 that we don't take as new covenant instructions. Verse 3 condemns hypocrisy. Verse 5 denounces pride and promotes humility. Verses 8 and 10 instructs not to elevate any man above Christ. Verse 11 fosters servanthood. Verse 14 vilifies theft. Verse 16 censors frivolous swearing. Verse 25 denounces extortion and excess. And verse 26 and 28 condemns white and sepulchre syndrome. Now, everyone would agree that all of that is as much applicable under the new covenant as it was to the Pharisees and the others living under the old covenant when it was stated. And yet, everybody, I think, would agree with that. I can't imagine anybody disagreeing with that. And yet, when the tithe opposers get to Yeshua's statement promoting tithing, they yank it out of all of these other new covenant instructions and then declare that it's only old covenant applicable. Now, at the very least, that's extremely arbitrary, inconsistent, and perhaps self-serving at the same time. It suddenly hit me as I was writing the previous statement in my notes that it's always the tithe promoters who are accused of teaching a self-serving doctrine. And granted, for some preachers, I think probably relatively few when you consider all of the preachers across this land, but still for some preachers, it's precisely that. It is self-serving. But what's often missed, I've always missed it, never thought about it. But the same accusation can also be leveled at the non-tithers as well. After all, if they can convince themselves that the tithe is no longer applicable, then they don't have to part with 10% of their increase. They get to keep it. Now, do I believe that the motivation of everyone opposed to the new, that is the motivation of everyone opposed to a new covenant tithe? Of course not. No more than I believe the same accusation applies to all tithe promoters. And therefore, those kinds of arguments have no place in this debate. And yet, usually, you'll find, particularly with this letter writer in question, that their position is filled with those kinds of arguments. They've got no place in it whatsoever, because both positions can be self-serving if that's the intent of the person on either side of the debate. Back to Matthew 23:23 now. Costin Harrell, in his book Stewardship and the Tithe, on page 46 and 47, put it this way as it concerns Matthew 23:3. He begins by quoting, "You pay tithe and of mint and a." Begins quoting Yeshua, where he said, "You pay tithe and mint and anise and cumin and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought ye to have done, and not to leave the other undone." End of quote, Matthew 23:3. Then he goes back to the beginning or part of it and he says, "These," quoting again, "these," in brackets, "the tithes, these ought you have done." End of quote, within a quote in that case. Could, he says, "these, the tithes, ought you have to done, could approval be more explicit?" Yeshua's approval of the tithe? Of course not. Yes, Jesus was insisting on inward righteousness in contrast to the spirit of legalism. But he insisted also that inward righteousness, judgment, mercy, and faith does not cancel out the disciplines of life. Among the disciplines which he includes is the tithe. End of his quote. Specifically, the tithe in this instance. And with that, and because everything else in this chapter everything else in this chapter is New Covenant applicable. So is Yeshua's tithe instruction as well. Next, let's examine some of Paul's teachings. And let's do with the letter writer's comments in mind. That is that Paul allegedly nowhere even hinted at a tithe. Let's see if there's any validity to that. Let's begin by turning to Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2 and verses 21 through 23. Romans chapter 2, beginning with verse 21, it says, "Now therefore, which teacheth another," or who teaches another, "teachest thou not thyself? Thou that preachest a man should not steal, dost thou steal? Thou that saith a man should not commit adultery, dost thou commit adultery? Thou that abhorrest idols, dost thou commit sacrilege? Thou that," he sums it up here, he says, "thou that makest thy boast in the law," or of the law, "through breaking the law dishonorest thou God." He's dealing with the Judahites here who had this claim to the law, and he says, now wait a minute, just because you have a claim to the law doesn't mean anything. If you can claim the law, but if you're out here breaking it, if you're condemning one person on one hand and you go out and do the same thing, you're nothing but a hypocrite. He's dealing with the hypocrisy of those who demanded from someone else that they keep the law and yet broke it themselves. Now back to verse 22 in particular. King James Version, latter part of it says, "Thou that abhorrest idols, dost thou commit sacrilege?" That's King James. New American Standard Bible says it this way, "You who abhor idols," and this is completely different, it says, "do you rob temples?" Now, granted, Paul's meaning in this verse, here's another one of Paul's writings that's a little bit obscure, and depending upon the translation you're using can lead you to different conclusions. Well, I want to see if we can't clear this up. We discussed this as a family here a couple weeks ago and didn't get a consensus then, but I think I've come up with some things that can clear this up. Paul's here either referring to those who literally rob idolatrous temples, robs the idols, takes them, or he's referring to robbing God, robbing the temple of God, and thus robbing God. In other words, the hypocrisy of abhorring idols, which it says they did, while at the same time stealing from the God that they say they worship. Which seems the more reasonable explanation? I know what some of my family members said earlier, but let's see if it may not change. For anyone inclined to say the former, consider the following, if you will. If these Judahites were stealing from idolatrous temples, it wasn't to worship the idols they were stealing. That's clear. Because the one thing to their credit was that they abhorred idols. So if they were stealing from idolatrous temples, it wasn't to bring them into their homes and have them around their house for whatever reason. They abhorred them. So that could not have been their motivation for stealing, for going into an idolatrous temple and stealing the idols, if that's in fact what is being discussed here. If, on the other hand, they were stealing them to destroy them, which seems the only logical explanation for those who would abhor idols to go and steal them, if indeed that's what they were doing, what would be the crime? Or even the hypocrisy in them doing so? Remember, verse 23 says, the summation of all of this says, you know, you can't claim to have the law and then go out and break it. Where would be the breaking of Yahweh's law if they were going into idolatrous temples, taking out the idols, and because of their abhorrence of idolatry, destroying the idols? There wouldn't be any. Yahweh's law, in fact, commands, does it not, His people to destroy idols when they can, and the temples of such idolatry in their lands. And thus, therefore, going in, stealing an idol and destroying it could not be a part of their hypocrisy, could not be disobedience to the laws of God. It would be an obedience to the laws of God. Consequently, I don't see how Paul can be referring to idolatrous temple robbers in this passage at all. It makes much more sense, and I think the only plausible explanation, that he was referring to the hypocrisy of those who abhorred and condemned the fidelity of the idolaters to their false gods, while at the same time not devoted themselves enough to Yahweh, their God, to give him his due. You see the hypocrisy then in that situation? In other words, they, I believe what Paul is describing here, is that they were new covenant God robbers like those prophesied in the book, or in Malachi chapter 3, which would indeed be sacrilegious, as the King James has it, with what belongs to God. It would also fulfill the condemnation of hypocrisy as well. Barnes notes, you might want to consider what Barnes notes has on Romans 2:22 regarding the frame, "Does thou commit sacrilege," in the King James. Barnes put it this way: "Sacrilege is the crime of violating or profaning sacred things, or of appropriating to common purposes what has been devoted to the service of religion. In this question, the apostle shows remarkable tact and skill. He could not accuse them of idolatry, for the Jews, at least the ones he's referring to here, after the Babylonian captivity, had never fallen into it. But then, though they had not the form, they might have the spirit of idolatry. That spirit consisted in withholding from the true God what was his due, and bestowing the affections upon something else. This the Jews did by perverting from their proper use the offerings which were designed for his honor, by withholding what he demanded of tithes and offerings, and by devoting to other uses what was devoted to him, and which properly belonged to his service. That this was the common crime among them is apparent from Malachi 1:8-12-14 and 3:8-9, end of quote. So you can see that Barnes himself applies Malachi 3 to this very situation. And there's more in Barnes as well that deals with a little bit more of this that I didn't clip out, but you might want to look at that as well. You'll find similar thoughts, by the way, in Matthew Henry's commentary, also tying it in with Malachi chapter 3. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown not only ties Romans chapter 2 and verse 22 back to the prophecies in Malachi chapter 3, but he also refers to, as an example, to Nehemiah chapter 13, Nehemiah 13:10-12, where it says, "And I perceived that the portions of the Levites had not been given them. For," this is during Nehemiah's day, but as an example for what Paul was also addressing, obviously not as it concerns the Levites, but in a new covenant fashion, he says, "had not been given to them, for the Levites and the singers that did the work were fled every one to his field." In other words, he didn't have enough money to devote his time to the law of God and the necessities of the kingdom, so he had to go out and he had to work. And it's a shame that there are good men today that should be able to devote their time to the kingdom work and who can't because of people rejecting the tithe today as well. Then contended I with the rulers and said, "Why is the house of God forsaken?" And the kingdom is what he's talking about. "And I gathered them together and set them in their place, then brought all Judah the tithe of the corn and the new wine and the oil into the treasuries." End of quoting from Nehemiah 13. And therefore, I am completely convinced that it was sacrilege that Paul was referring to in Romans chapter 2:22, the sacrilege and the hypocrisy of those who condemned idolatry but didn't think enough of their own God in order not to rob his tithes and offerings from him. One more passage I think we can cover before we close this down today. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 16. I think you'll find this hopefully interesting as well. 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store as God has prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. So he says, for the sake of the churches, I want you to take up a collection, and as God has prospered you, put it aside and store it up. The phrase in this, in verse 2 here, as God has prospered him, is one which free will givers only like to latch onto. I'm not sure why, but they like to latch onto it because they believe that such language is only representative of free will offerings. But listen, nothing, this couldn't be more wrong. In fact, it's just the opposite. As, think about the phrase, as God has prospered thee. They say, well, there's no mandatoriness in that. But think about that. As God has prospered thee is clearly speaking of an increase. As God has prospered thee above and beyond your normal expenses, as God has prospered thee, God doesn't expect them to give, not that he doesn't bless when one does, but out of their need or when expenses aren't, but he says, as I have prospered thee, is clearly increase, is clearly talking, discussing an increase from which a tithe is paid. It's not free will offering, and not a free will offering discussion here. It is a tithe discussion that he's saying lay aside. As Paul was in the habit of doing, either directly quoting, which he often did, or employing the language of Yahweh's laws and thereby applying Old Covenant law to the New Covenant, he was doing the exact same thing here. And remember, Paul's Bible that he referred to in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verses 16 and 17, from which he received his instruction in righteousness and passed on to others, was the Old Testament. The New Testament wasn't written yet, particularly the laws of Yahweh. So let's see if we can't find, if this is not another case of him not using Old Testament law language and applying it to the New Covenant. As we find in the old in Yahweh's law. Turn to Deuteronomy 16. Deuteronomy 16, let's begin verses 9 and 10. Verse 9, he says, 7 weeks shall thou number unto thee, begin to number the 7 weeks from such time as thou beginnest to put the sickle to the corn. And thou shalt keep the feast of weeks unto Yahweh thy God with a tribute of a free will offering of thine hand, which thou shalt give, listen to this, unto Yahweh thy God, according as Yahweh thy God has blessed thee. According to how Yahweh thy God has blessed thee. Note the phrase, as God has blessed thee, which is nearly identical. And in fact, in the Greek maybe, to Paul's phrase in 1 Corinthians 16 and verse 2, as God has prospered him. It's just a difference of prospered and blessed. Same idea, certainly. Yeah, but, I'm going to be quick to point out this. Yeah, but, this proves a free will offering, not a tithe. Isn't that what it's talking about? A free will offering right there. Surely. Verse 10. Well, not so fast. Jump down to verse 16. Verse 16, it says, Three times in a year shall all thy males appear before Yahweh thy God in the place which he shall choose, in the feast of unleavened bread, in the feast of weeks, and in the feast of tabernacles, and they shall not appear before Yahweh empty or empty-handed, I believe the New American Standard says. What was required at those three festivals? Well, particularly a tithe. Particularly a tithe. You can go check that out for yourself, if you don't already know that. With that in mind, jump to verse 17. Every man shall give at these three festivals, particularly the tithe, the poor tithe, the third tithe to himself for his family, and a tithe to Yahweh and via the Levites. And he says, and every man shall give as he is able according to the blessing of Yahweh thy God, which he hath given thee. So what does the statement, quote, as he is able according to the blessing of Yahweh, end of quote, that essentially Paul employed in 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2 refer to? Not free will offerings only, but offerings and tithes, as is clearly depicted in this particular passage. Furthermore, note that the collection in 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and 2, note what it was for. It was for the saints, right? That's what he says. It was for the saints. And the New Covenant saints are what? They're the New Covenant temple, aren't they? We're all the temple of the Holy Spirit. We're the New Covenant temple. And the Old Covenant temple, a type of the New Covenant temple, was prefigured or preceded by what? The Old Covenant tabernacle. Turn to Numbers very quickly. I think we can get this in here. Numbers chapter 18, I'll just read it. Verse 21, here's what we find. And it says, "And behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tenth," or the tithe, "in Israel for an inheritance, for their service which they serve, even the service of the tabernacle of the congregation." You know, it's interesting that everybody understands, I think, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but most people understand that the tabernacle in the wilderness and then the temple was all typology of, a lot of people think, the church, really more broad than that, the kingdom of God here on earth under the new covenant. You know, the Holy of Holies and the holy place. We find much of this in the book of Hebrews, the typology from one to the other, the menorah, the candle, the candlestick of seven, whatever, candles. The incense, the altar of sacrifice, and all of everything, even the walls and everything else, was, everybody sees as typology for the new covenant kingdom, except for those who don't want to see a new covenant tithe. They see it all as typology, except for how the tabernacle was financed, and that they want to leave behind in the old covenant. Now, we're going to look at some more passages here in the next message, New Testament passages to finalize this point. But I'd say already that Paul did a whole lot more than merely hint at a new covenant tithe. He employed language for the tithe and applied old covenant language for the tithe and applied it to the new covenant ecclesia. And being that the Old Testament scriptures were the Corinthians' Bible as well. We already talked about it was Paul's Bible. Well, then it was the Corinthians' Bible as well, because the New Testament wasn't written yet. They, and I think this is important to realize this, that they, at least their elders, their teachers, their pastors, would have recognized Paul's statement in this particular instance and others as right out of the law pertaining to tithe, to offerings and tithes alike, making it unnecessary for Paul to have to use the word tithe. Their Bible was the Old Covenant, Deuteronomy chapter 16. They knew that that phrase he used was applicable to both offerings and tithes. He did more than just hint. He provided right out of the Old Testament the language of the tithe and applied it to the New Covenant ecclesia and or Yahweh's kingdom. Now, there's more to come. We've got just a few more passages to cover from Paul's writings to further prove that, in fact, Paul did, in fact, teach a tithe without ever using the word. Okay, let's stand. We'll close this one in prayer. Heavenly Father, once again, we thank you, Father, for your insight, for your insights from your word, Lord, that you've opened this certainly up more to me than I've ever understood or seen before. And I thank you for those insights and pray, Lord, that you would be able to pass them on to the hearts and minds of those who, Father, desire your will and need that understanding, who perhaps haven't gotten it yet. We do ask, Lord, that you'd use this, Father, message once again to your praise and glory and for the sake of building your kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven. We ask these things and we praise you now in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.